the more you can be in touch with your own humanity, the more you connect to the universal principles in every human being. And I think that's really, really important. And I think that's how you find your own voice. The problem is that the faster way to grow is to be a subtle shadow of someone else.
Erwin, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Very honored and humbled for you to be here and excited for our conversation.
Danny, thank you so much for having me. And it's good to meet you too.
The most spiritual activity you will ever engage in is to choose. What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I grew up a fairly irreligious person, you know, without any formal religion or belief system. And so when I became an adult and I began interacting with faiths for the first time, I was a philosophy student, but I was a philosopher. And, you know, I really tried to understand human existence, significance, meaning, from a probably a non-spiritual space, not just non-religious, but a non-spiritual space. And then when I became a person of faith and I began to see the world through spirituality, I felt like people were almost magical in their thinking, that they would just hope that things would turn out or God would make things better, or if they believed, everything would change. And you can hear the language both inside and outside of traditional, you know, religion. You know, you have people who talk about manifesting your future, or, you know, whatever, sending out the right frequency or speaking things into existence. And so, you know, it's not just monopolized by people in the Christian world. And one day I just realized that we were discounting the power of choice. And so in our house, we would actually have a little paper that would say the most spiritual thing you will do today is to choose, and to remind us that every day we have the capacity to create, and that the future isn't only mysterious. You know, there's a lot of unknown, there's a lot of uncertain, a lot of things out of our control, but that the future doesn't happen to us, it happens through us, that we are actually creating the future to the choices we make. And so I wanted to highlight and emphasize the creative power of every human being, because when we choose, we're actually creating, which is a very spiritual thing.
Wow. And it's so true that before you do anything, before you pray, you choose to pray. Before you meditate, you choose to meditate. Before you go to church, you choose to go to church.
And it's so like, whatever you consider your most spiritual activity, before you did it, you had to choose it.
Wow. And sometimes it feels like we're chosen. Like the activity, like it feels like for me doing this podcast, there was no option for me to do it or not do it. It was just like, I have to. What's that all about?
On the upside, I would say you did have a choice. And you were just compelled to make that choice. But I would also say that other people's choices affect us. And, you know, so you could be living an incredibly beautiful life, go through a green light, somebody chose to drink, somebody chose to get behind the wheel, and they crash into your car and leave you paralyzed, not because of a choice you made, but because of a choice someone else made. And so we can see the dramatic effect of other people's choices on our lives. And then on a larger scale, I'm convinced God chooses, and he chooses you. He chooses us. He chooses humanity, and he's choosing the good. He's choosing beauty. He's choosing hope. And so there's a part of me that goes, all right, someone's negative choices can impact me, and someone's positive choices can actually impact me. How much more if you have a God who's actually choosing you? And so maybe there's a sense, Danny, where God chose you to do that podcast, and then he invited you into that choice. And so now he's choosing you, but you have to choose it as well. And that's where it becomes really powerful.
That's so beautiful. And you talk about the situation with the drunk driver. I know you were in a collision and that played a critical role in your life not too long ago. Could you tell that story, please?
Well, I've been in so many collisions, I'm not even sure which one you're talking about.
The one related to the cancer. Really? You've been in a lot of collisions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, quite a few. Now, I got hit head on by a car when I was 19 years old running across a highway, left paralyzed from the waist down. It wasn't the first time I got hit by a car. It's also not the first time I hit a car. You know, so I've had lots of collisions. I was on my little, electric bike and going down L.A. and wiped out and on a hard left turn and wiped out in the middle of traffic and almost got run over by cars. And so, yeah, I'm a little maybe reckless at times. My daughter and son used to tell me I wasn't going to live past, you know, a certain age because they were sure I was just so reckless that I would end up ending my life shortly. But yeah, I had cancer 7 years ago, which is a collision of a sort. Mm-hmm. And when you hear those words, it's really surreal. And it had a tremendous impact on my family. It was right before Christmas, which is right before my wife's birthday in December. And so it was a really heavy like season for us. And I had stage 4 cancer and it had metastasized. So, you just never know how things are going to play out in a situation like that. But it was, to me, it was a great like moment for self-awareness to know. You never know how you're going to respond to something like that until you're in it. You never know who you are sometimes until you're in a severe pressure cooker in life. And what was amazing to me, and it surprised me, I didn't expect it. I just never felt fear. And it's not that I've never felt fear in my life. I want to be very clear. I have definitely felt fear in my life. But in that moment, I think because it was so serious and it seemed so terminal, somehow my inner world didn't go to fear. And I think it's because I didn't really let myself become self-indulgent. And I was really focused on Kim, my wife, and Aaron and Mariah, you know, my kids, and Patty, my foster daughter, and just the impact on their lives and, you know, and just trying to think through how to leave them well if I was leaving. And then I was finishing a book called The Last Arrow, and I just wanted to leave that book in the best condition possible. So I wanted to finish editing it. And I think what actually happened in retrospect is I was so focused on if I was exiting to exit well. And I also had, I also knew, you know, I'm sort of a mildly like public personality. And a lot of people around the world follow me and listen to my messages and follow my life. And I was acutely aware that I had a lot of people who did not believe in God who believed in me as a human being. And how I process this would have a significant impact on their ability to believe. And so I had a lot of factors just weighing on me. And I'm really grateful for them because it didn't allow me to become self-indulgent in that season.
What happened with the car crash?
Oh, well, you know, I had 6 hours of surgery. And, where the morning of the surgery, the surgeon came in or they told me that the cancer had spread further than they expected. And so it was going to take longer than they thought. And a 2-hour surgery became a 6-hour surgery. And it is a surreal thing when you don't know if you're going to wake up. Like, I don't know if I can adequately communicate that to someone who's never been there. But when you choose to go under so that they can save your life and you say goodbye, you're saying goodbye. And it really is a different kind of mental space that you have to be in your life. And by the way, all the research I've seen says that about 40% of the dynamic of surviving cancer is your mental state of being. And I just had this deep sense that I was going to be okay, that I was going to wake up, and that I was going to overcome this. And I don't even like the word survive. Like, I've never called myself a cancer survivor. People go, oh, you're a cancer survivor. I'm not. Like, I'm not defined by that. I've survived 65 years of reckless living. cancer was a passive challenge. I've had other more dynamic choice challenges in my life. And so when I recovered, when I woke up, I wasn't surprised I was awake. And when I became cancer free, I wasn't surprised I was cancer free. I was grateful, really grateful, but not surprised. And when I came out of it stronger than ever, I wasn't surprised. When I was playing basketball 3 months later, I wasn't surprised by that. And I think that your mental fortitude has a lot to do with your recovery.
Absolutely. No, I'd listened to you on In My Let's Show talk about how on the way to one of the surgeries, you got into a car crash, or on the way to something as related to the cancer. And so you were like, I'm going to die before I even go into the surgery.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's accurate.
That's another car crash. I forgot about that one. So this is crazy. So we had this really nice SUV, and my wife wanted to give it to this family that didn't have a car. And so I went and got it detailed. I paid all this money to get it detailed, make it look brand new, just get the engine, everything checked, you know. And it's a few days before I go in for surgery for cancer. I pick it up. I'm driving it home. I'm just blocks from my house. I mean, I could almost throw a Frisbee to my house from where I was. I'm driving, and these guys in a white truck decide, not only are we going to run the stop sign, but we're going to go through like at 50 miles an hour. Oh my God. And by the way, they were both undocumented. So,
oh my God. And it's only funny because you're here.
And because I'm also an immigrant. But and so they crash into my car, my wife's car, actually, total it. That's how hard they hit it. They total it. Their truck goes spinning around. They get out. They're fine. The reason I mentioned they were undocumented is because they ran because they were undocumented. So they didn't have any insurance or anything. And what's so funny is that I actually talked to them after I got out. I didn't even think about the fact they were just going to run because I wasn't upset at them. I literally got out of the car thinking to myself, I'm not even going to make it to surgery. I'm going to die from a hit and run. And I had to call my wife, and that couple was waiting for us at our house. Oh my God. For the car. So, you know, you just never know in life. Like it's just, you know, if you live in fear of death, you just never have the courage to live. So you just have to just take it on.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. And I want to go to, you know, a lot of people will have unforeseen situations happen to them that put them in worse situations. It didn't sound like in that moment you had any resentment, and it was almost like it happened and then you forgave them within the same moment. And that is an amazing place to be, and a place more people wish they could be. What do you say by way of advice to someone who's holding onto a grudge and has been for a long time about a situation that happened seemingly to them, and they don't know how to handle it or forgive the person?
Yeah, you know, it's always crazy to me that people decide to be bitter towards someone that they wish was not a part of their story. And because here's the thing, as long as you're bitter, you're in someone else's story, not your own. And the only way you can get out of their story and back into your story is through forgiveness. So as unfair and unattractive as forgiveness is, and I understand. I mean, you know, if I say like forgiveness sucks, you know, because it's like, you know, you're not just forgiving someone who wants forgiveness, right? That's a little bit easier. You're forgiving someone who may not even want forgiveness. You're having to forgive someone who doesn't even feel they need it. There's just nothing more irritating than forgiving someone who still hasn't understood that they need forgiveness. So you clearly don't forgive for them, right? Because they may not even want it. They may not embrace it. They may actually feel resentful that you're forgiving them. Who do you think you are to forgive me? Even it makes it worse. The only reason you really forgive is for yourself in the purest level. One, well, I mean, there is a beautiful thing. When you forgive someone, you're setting them free. You're setting them free from the guilt and shame of an act that needs forgiveness. And so when a person really wants forgiveness, it's a liberating moment for them. If a person hasn't really acknowledged they need forgiveness, it doesn't set them free at all because they're still trapped in their own narcissism. But it sets you free, and you're back in your own story. You know, I have just so many, to me, tragic examples of unforgiveness going wrong. I mean, I, I, um, I've gotten so many. I'll just one. I got an email from someone from around the world, other side of the planet, asking me for forgiveness for something they did like 15 years ago.
Wow.
And it was really detailed. And frankly, I have like a neurological condition where I have like an eidetic memory. I can remember everything, but I also remember nothing. So I have no sense of chronology. So I can't remember if it was yesterday or last month or last year. So calendaring is really challenging for me. But I don't remember things we should be resentful about. So if you wrong me, not only do I forget the wrong, I actually forget you. It's a weird thing. It goes to a part of my brain where there is no memory recall.
Wow.
And so I'm reading this email, and only as they describe it do I remember it. I'd completely forgotten it for 15 years. And then the moment they're telling me everything they did, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh wow, how could they do that? Oh man, that was really wrong. I'm like vicariously experiencing it for the first time in 15 years. And then they go on and explain to me how this has haunted them for 15 years.
Wow.
And how this has tormented them, and they just never could get to a place of humility to ask for forgiveness. And my response to them was immediate. Not only did I forgive you 15 years ago, I didn't even remember it. I said, the only real tragedy here is that you didn't ask for forgiveness right away so that you could be free. This has haunted you for decades, and it didn't need to because it didn't haunt me. And I think sometimes when we don't forgive, we're the only one we're haunting. And it's just so much better to be free. I had a friend of mine yesterday. He did something that I didn't really think was like the smartest thing. I responded in a mildly public because we're in a group text together. Then he sent me a private text saying, you really hurt me. You know, that really affected me, went on. And my immediate thought is, hey, we're big boys. These are all really successful people, 100 millionaires, billionaires, you know, written 20, 30 books. All these people are super successful. And I'm like, let's put our big boy pants on. How can you be offended? And then I immediately thought, wow, this is my friend. And I hurt him. And I didn't even mean to. I was just joking around. But he took my humor and took it really personally, and it hurt him deeply. And I thought, what does it cost me to be genuinely sorry? So I said, I would never mean to hurt you. It was completely unintentional. I profoundly apologize. I was unwise in my response. And he responded, wow, oh, thank you for the response. It did hurt. Thank you for saying that. I don't think people expect you to apologize right away. I actually think I catch people off guard because I apologize really fast. You know, it's like I just go, oh yeah, I messed up. Yeah, you know, I make mistakes. Sometimes I don't read a situation the way I should, or I say something that I didn't know was going to affect a person a certain way. And it's so much easier just to go, yeah, it doesn't matter if I thought it was right. It just, if it hurt you, I'm sorry. And then a lot of times they don't know what to do because they want to feel angry longer. You know? Like, I've been married 40 years. Let me tell you, when I ask for forgiveness fast, it really frustrates Kim. Because she wants to, you know, carry just a little bit longer, you know. She wants to fight. She wants to, you know. And so sometimes I have to go, okay, I need to ask forgiveness fast, but realize that, you know, there's going to be a little residual battle that's needed just for emotional catharsis along the way.
That's funny that you bring up the marriage situation, because I, when doing research for this, I found out that when you go away on trips, your wife sometimes takes a day or two to get back to the place you were when you left.
Yeah, or a week or two.
A week or two. Wow. Okay. And so in that moment, you could say, I'm sorry, forgive me for being away. But how do you make that week or two a shorter amount of time?
Yeah, first of all, you realize it's not logical, it's relational. Mm. But it's not irrational and it's not illogical, it's just relational. And, you know, sometimes we try to act like if someone else is feeling something emotionally, but you're not feeling it emotionally, it's irrational. That's not real. Emotions are real, but emotions are not reality. And so you have to kind of like work through that and go, okay, I don't feel these emotions are reality, but I can't discount them because they are real. So if I don't address them as if they're real, we're never going to get past this. And so some of it is, I'm hearing it as, not I'm mad at you because you were gone on this trip, but I need you to show me how much you love me and how much you missed me and how much I'm valued. And so you got to win me back. And I need to be redated. And it's true. Yeah, I think we all want someone, someone who fights for us.
Yeah, and we all want to know that we're loved, even if we know that intellectually, we need to feel it emotionally or spiritually as well, which is a very interesting and fascinating thing about human nature. Who is the most free person you know?
I don't know if anyone's ever asked me that question. Good question, Danny. I love unexpected questions. And, you know, it feels terrible. I think I'm the most free person.
I would say you're up there. You know, I've done this 400 times. I sense a real sense of freedom and peace within you.
Yeah, I think that genuinely, and it's hard for me to answer the question because I feel like I spent so much of my life trying to help people get free. And I find that so many of my friends who have all the advantages of freedom are not free. And so it can be a really like elusive thing. And so, you know, I look and I go, I don't know. Sometimes they're free in a moment.
Free when that the money comes into their account. They get an uptick of 1 million followers. Free in, you know, they feel really good with their wife or significant other. They're free in that moment. But freedom is about all situations or as many situations as you can, being able to be with yourself and being comfortable.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then when I think I have a friend who's like super free, then I find out he's like suffering from anxiety attacks. Mm. And I go, oh, wow. You know, I have another friend and like, oh, he must be super free. And then he's like, I mean, I've done ayahuasca like 26 times. And I go, oh, man, you're not free. You know? And so, you know, a lot of times I think I actually have friends that, you know, I go, you know, they're free. But so I think that freedom is a very fragile thing. And because every freedom brings new responsibility.
Mm.
Yeah. And we think freedom is freedom from responsibility, but actually freedom moves us to responsibility. And then that new level of responsibility can actually feel like it costs us our freedom, but you have to keep moving forward. And so, you know, maybe freedom is a process more than a destination.
Could you talk a little bit more, like using a specific example of how an increase in your own freedom led to more responsibilities?
Yeah. When I was, how old are you, Danny?
28.
All right. When I was your age. All right. So when I was 28, I was traveling here and there speaking for free, right? Because that's what I was worth. You know? And, you know, if you covered my gas, I would drive to Montana, you know, and even if you didn't cover my gas, I would just find a way. And my wife, you know, we were married at 25. She go, you can't keep traveling and speaking for free, but I would, right. You know, and then when I was 29 with about an hour's notice, maybe 40 minutes notice, I was asked to fill in for a speaker to an audience of 20,000 people. And it transformed my life as a public speaker. And all of a sudden, I'm being invited all over the country and then soon all over the world. Well, this is one way I would explain it. At first, it was like, I said yes to everything. Like, you know, the sign that it was from God was, I got asked.
And, that's great.
And then when I started getting asked, I had more freedom now. Because now I was getting asked so many places, I didn't have enough time. And so then it was like, okay, you had to at least pay my expenses. You know, and then it's still like the filter wasn't strong enough. I just would have so many invitations. that I couldn't take them all. So then it was like, okay, you had to, there has to be like an honorarium, whatever, $1,000. And, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but that's how I started. And frankly, I had to keep creating more and more filters. And there came a certain point where almost any amount of money, people would end up saying yes. And I would have to filter going, okay, wait a minute. So it can't just be about like the speaking fee. It has to be about intention or purpose. It has to be about relationships. Or maybe it's about my own sense of calling. Like I'm a city person. So I would choose cities over, you know, suburbs. And so every time I grew, every time I had more freedom, because believe me, the more income you have incredible opportunity for more freedom. I mean, there's just, that's just a reality. And I wanted to travel the world. And in fact, now, like, even though it's been, you know, 30, 40 years, I still save the shampoo and the conditioner from the hotels. And, you know, my wife was like, you know that we can afford those now. I know, but you know how long I was like not using it so I could bring home shampoo and, you know, and I'd use one soap and I'd stay in a hotel for 4 days so that I could bring three soaps so we could have soap and, you know, early on. And then I would say, oh, I got the speaking engagement to like Seoul, Korea or Buenos Aires, Argentina. And I'll go, oh, I should go. And my executive assistant who's been with me for decades goes, you know, you can afford to go there now, just on your own. Like you don't have to have a speaking engagement to go there. And my mind still doesn't remember, you know, because the only way I got to travel the world was by working 40 hours in 4 days to get to be there and then sneaking out for 3 hours to go see the city, you know, and my life is so full of freedom now that I have the responsibility to only choose the things that match my intention, that take me to the places where I can make the greatest impact, to make sure I'm speaking to the right audiences, because there are a lot of great audiences that I should not be speaking to. Mm. And some of it is, it's different for me than from other people. Like, my communication frequency is something that would be described as a maven. And so only about 1-5% of the culture will actually embrace what I have to say. Large crowds usually don't need my message. They need someone who inspires them. They need someone who motivates them. They need someone who cheers them on and you know, calls them up. And I would never travel the world just to inspire. Like, I travel the world to transform the way people think. And so I have to make sure that the audience is the right audience for my message. But honestly, when I was younger, I didn't ask that. Every audience was the right audience, you know. I was not selective in any way. And so more freedom takes more responsibility. I'm just giving you a practical application for my life. And so now I look at invitations. I have to go, does this advance the particular mission I feel called to fulfill in my life? Because at this stage in my life, I need to be far more intentional. And ironically, my number one filter is relationships. Mm. I ask myself, are these people I want to have an ongoing relationship with? Because one night stands in the speaking world just doesn't feel like a great use of my time.
Mm, that's very well said. What do you look for in relationships?
People who are trying to do for the world, in the world, things that I think are important that matter, make the world better, help people achieve their greatest capacity to be better human beings. And so I look for those kinds of, you know, markers, and then I want to help them.
It's beautiful. When a lot of people listening to this might be going through a season similar to the one you're talking about, where they say yes to everything, and now they're in the position of saying, there's a lot of stuff coming my way, and I got to figure out how to say no to this stuff and what to say no to. What should people be thinking about as they enter this new season of their life?
Yeah, I think pragmatically you have to, you know, when you're a plumber or an electrician, you don't go, oh, the people who live in that house, they don't match my value system. You know, you go, that house needs an electrician. I'm going to be the best electrician in the world, and I'm going to fix the electricity. And I think early on when you're trying to build, let's say, a speaking career, you know, you can't be as
Discerning.
discerning, or I don't even want to use that word, is like it discriminating as maybe you can be later. You know, I think early on you go, if I get the platform, I'm going to bring my best self and I'm going to try to impact the environment the best I can. And I think that's where you take on your, like, your personal responsibility. You go, my 30 minutes, my 45 minutes, I'm going to bring the best version of me and let the chips fall where they may. So early on in my life, I didn't get invited back. you know, I'd always tell myself, you're only going to get to speak once because your message is a little hard to embrace. So bring the best message you can, shake everybody up, change the way people think, let the chips fall where they may. And one of the things I really say is, look, just be true to yourself, bring your best self, and let the audience find you. Let the platform find you. Don't be what you think the platform needs. Be yourself, and the platform that needs you will find you. And I think that's really important. Otherwise, in the long term, you won't know who you are, and you will not find your own voice.
Yes. And people are more than ever, they have more external voices coming at them. This podcast is an example of an external voice that's coming at you. How do we push people more to listen to their own voice or God's voice as opposed to the external?
I mean, I think some of it, Danny, is like when you're asking questions, is ask the questions that really matter to you. You know, don't try to figure out what are the questions the audience really wants, you know, or what are the best questions that will get me, you know, help me be viral, you know, but like ask the questions that really matter to you. And what you'll find is those are the questions that really matter to people. And, you know, cause the more you can be in touch with your own humanity, the more you connect to the universal principles in every human being. And I think that's really, really important. And I think that's how you find your own voice. The problem is that the faster way to grow is to be a subtle shadow of someone else. Oof.
And that's a great line.
You know, and so if you can find a way to kind of mirror or echo popular people, you can actually grow faster. But what you will find is the magnetic pull of that person will make you an imitation of them rather than a true, like, expression of your uniqueness. And so it's way better just to go, I want to find my own unique voice and let the growth happen organically. That, but you're asking someone who's a pre-social media person, you know, but that's the way I would see the world.
No, I think there's something incredibly powerful about that. And I think that what happens when you follow someone else's voice is you get to a certain point and then you look at yourself in the mirror and you say, oh my God, I am not me. And you get scared because what you see is not actually what you're projecting out into the world. And that's why it's so important. Like, I think about often someone like you, someone like Deion Sanders, who Deion Sanders doesn't know Instagram. He doesn't know YouTube, but he knows how to captivate people and he knows how to give his experiences in a real way. And that connects because it doesn't matter about the platform. It matters about the soul of who he is and his work and accomplishments and what he's able to put forward.
Yeah, and me and Deion are so similar.
You're preaching the word of God, though.
And that's what Deion does, man.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I just think, you know, love or hate him, he's just himself.
Yes.
And that's really, in many ways, what sells really well, is he's not inconsistent to himself. He's very consistent to himself. And so he doesn't have to go in the room and go, oh, which Deion should I be right now? You know, he's just Deion, and the environment changes, situation changes. They lose, they win, and he's still Deion. And which I think is funny when people are surprised how he owns losing. They're going, no, that's actually very true to who he is. He owns his greatness. He owns his talent. He owns his uniqueness. He also owns the reality of losing, you know, and because it's a part of the game, right? You know, and I don't think he, I do think he hates losing. But I don't think he expects to never lose. But I do think he expects his players to never give up. And I think that's where, like, there's an interesting, like, tension there. And in his mind, I'm certain, he thinks if you execute and don't give up, you will never lose. Like, I think he has that self-belief.
100%.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's able to say, okay, even if this happens, I'm able to quickly go, just like you with the forgiveness, mm-hmm. to in that moment, all right, we lost. Now let's, what are we going to do from here? That is the superpower.
That's right. That's actually the definition of resilience, really. It's how fast you recover from failure.
And teaching resilience is more important than ever, because you can have, if you help someone go from being into the negative to the positive, from 1 year to 1 second, you are helping save that person a year of their life, right? Like 15 years of that woman's life or that man's life with your situation with the email, that person is dealing with that. But if they can go in that moment, that is like, that's an incredible thing. How do we get people or help people get to a quicker version of let's get on the right foot?
Yeah, I don't know why, but maybe because you're in your 20s, but what came to my mind right away is you just described why you shouldn't date the wrong person 1 day longer than you should. Because every day you're with the wrong person, you can't be with the right person.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think what happens is that we become comfortable with familiarity and we become afraid of uncertainty. But really the best options in life are always in the uncertainty, because they're in the unknown. And so if you're with the right person, like, you know, to me it's like, you need to close that deal. But if you are with the wrong person, or maybe you're the wrong person for that person, you know, it doesn't mean they're the wrong person for everyone. They're just the wrong person for you, because you're the wrong person for them. And I think sometimes the hardest thing to embrace is, oh, the best gift I can give that other person is to move on so that they can be positioned to find their right person. But it's true in everything in life. It's like the same, the right job. Like you do the wrong job for so long. You stay at a job you hate because you're so afraid of what isn't out there. And, you know, and this will be true in everything in life. And if you can actually develop the ability to recover rapidly. And by the way, it's one of the things that you look for when you're drafting quarterbacks. And you don't look at their statistics or just their, you know, the basic like scores for all the, you know, their jump, their ability to, you know, to have vertical leap or their accuracy. You look at how they play the game after their worst game.
Mm.
And so you want to find the worst game they ever had and then look at the next week, because then you'll know their mental recovery time. And this is, I think, one of the most significant attributes for success is how fast you can recover from devastation, from failure, from loss. And, you know, that moment that jars your self-belief, how fast can you recover and get back in the game?
What was the longest loss of your life that you let sit with you for the longest amount of time?
That's a really good question. And probably if I had more time to think about it, I might change my answer. But I had a company. I lost it in a day. I lost maybe $6 to $10 million of value. I had to take $1 million loan out to finish projects because of my business partner. And I couldn't hold food down for 30 days. Wow. Like I weigh about 200 pounds, and I got down to 160 something, which was like my high school weight, you know. And I couldn't eat. I just couldn't hold food down. So I don't know, you know. You can lie to yourself psychologically and go, "Oh, I recovered so fast," but what I do know is my body didn't recover for at least a month. You know, and I tried. I mean, I wasn't hungry, but two, I just functionally couldn't eat or hold food down. My body was just so paralyzed by this loss, and it wasn't the loss of money; it was the betrayal that I felt in that moment by how it happened and who did it. And then it took me 5 years to recover from the loss of wealth and the $1 million of debt. But in those 5 years, I did a lot of good. So you can be in recovery and still be in creation. Like, you don't have to make them sequential. You don't have to go, okay, I got to recover, and then I can get on to my life. I was like, no, I'm going to recover and get on with my life at the same time. I'm going to double track this baby.
Yeah, so, because when you're in that place of loss, or when you're recovering, that doesn't mean you can't pull up and help someone, even who's ahead of you.
That's like, right.
And so there's a false dichotomy of, oh, I'm depressed, so I can't help anyone because everyone has to help me. Well, why don't you help someone who's, you know, at a worse level of depression? You know, so what would you say to people in that
spot? Yeah, you only get depressed because you're only in recovery.
Mm.
And once you start doing good and serving other people and trying to make the world better, you actually have a reason to get up in the morning, and it becomes the enemy of depression. You actually go to war again. And so even in the middle of all that, I remember going back to Mosaic, the church we're part of, and I just said, hey, I have a lot of free time.
Wow.
And what do you guys need? And at that time, they said, we need you to step back into being like a creative director and bringing creativity and imagination and beauty back into our space. So I kind of, even though I started Mosaic, I kind of stepped back in as like a creative director. And it was just so much fun and so fulfilling. And, you know, so I just think you have to find a way to create while you're, in a sense, going through the recreation of yourself.
Yeah, so much of life, it feels like, is just being where your moment is, being where the moment is, mm-hmm. and not being in someplace else. It's why I've stopped using AirPods so much outside of just walking around, because I want to be present to the creation of what is happening and being able to witness all of the beauty and all of the situations and giving a little comment to someone here and being able to just connect with someone. All of that is being where your feet are and being present to what is happening in front of you instead of being in your own world, which I love doing, but is helpful to also remind yourself the importance of just being where you're at, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and really, you know, I really do like the adage that happiness is really about moments, not about like an environment, you know? And if you can just like keep moving and being fully present and being aware of all the opportunities around you. And I'm like a super, super high aesthetic. Like, I'm one of those ridiculous people that eats my food slow because I want to taste it. And, and I'll be the guy going, wow, like, feel the taste, the texture of that, or, you know, oh man, this is like, you know, sometimes it drives everybody crazy because I'm a little bit too aesthetic, you know, and
they're like, speed it up, Dad.
Yeah, you know, and I just enjoy like the coffee or the tea or the moments or the architecture, and like, it's just, I let myself drown in the beauty and wonder of moments, and I think it does make a huge, huge difference in life just to appreciate everything. In fact, tonight, me and a couple of friends are going to this little Japanese restaurant in LA that serves only sushi, and it's a Michelin star. It's in the Chef's Table series, and we're just going there just for the sheer experience of enjoying life. And a friend of ours, he actually got the reservation. He goes, hey, you guys want to go? Like, we're so in, you know, because, you know, for us, life is like beautiful moments and beautiful experiences with friends, and we'll talk about it for months, you know, and we'll talk to each other about it, and we'll brag about it to our friends that didn't get to go.
It's so wonderful that you can have such a simple experience of going to dinner with your friends and really like bathing in it, right? Mm-hmm. In a world that is constantly getting you to the next post, the next feed, the next thing, the next thing, go faster, go faster, go faster. Someone asked me today, like, or yesterday, what can you do to grow your podcast faster? I said, dude, why do I need to grow faster? I'm just enjoying the scenery of what we're doing right now, and it's amazing. And like slow down, and you can really see what's happening.
That's and funny. The friend who's taking us, he has like 7 people who follow him on Instagram. He even said one day, he goes, you know, he goes, because this friend, he started a company, sold it after 9 years for $1.2 billion. So he's been mildly successful in this life, you know, but he has 0 Instagram followers. Like, he couldn't care less.
Exactly.
And he said to me, he goes, you know, you're like the only friend that I bring that doesn't post on social media all the stuff we do together. You go, all the other guys, they're just like, they're putting it on their stories and everything like that. And I go, like, that's not why I'm going with you. Like, I'm just trying to enjoy this moment together. I'm not trying to like social media this thing to death. And I think sometimes we actually don't enjoy the moment because we're trying to make it bigger than it is for other people. And so it becomes smaller than it is for us.
That is so true and so powerful. How do we instill that into other human beings?
I think sometimes is have experiences you don't tell anyone about.
I love that.
You know? And like have experiences that are just truly intimate and private and personal and beautiful. And I did see this thing that said that couples that don't post about each other on social media actually have better marriages than people who do post. And I thought that's interesting because like my wife and I, like, she never posts about me. Like, she posts about Malawi. She's posted about building schools and building houses in Africa and helping refugees and giving, you know, students scholarships. She never posts anything about me. I don't even think she posts my book. I don't know. Cindy, the kid posts about my book. No, she didn't. Yeah. It's like, you know, I didn't even think to ask my wife, like, hey, are you posting about my book? You know? And, you know, we don't feel like we need to make like our 40-year love affair a public story, you know, because it's a real story. And, you know, and my kids, like they have a public life. I mean, Mariah, she's a musical artist and her husband, Jake, is also part of a band called Laney that he started. And, you know, they have millions of followers. But like they live a very private life. They're not posting to the world about how much they're in love and all the things they're doing in their marriage. And they've been married almost 9 years and like they have the most beautiful life. And Aaron is, you know, I mean, he has his own like celebrity, but he's like so private. You know, he's like, he's not trying to tell the world about what he's doing. And, you know, he's like really careful. When you need to be bigger to a stranger than you are to your friends, I think you're really unhealthy.
Yes. And to yourself, like when you need to bigger to someone else than you are to yourself, it's like, why not the relationship with yourself? Why not make that whole first? Yeah. And then worry about the relationship with friends and then worry about the relationship with acquaintance and then worry about the relationship with people you don't even know. Right. And it starts from within and making that good. And then everything else will ripple outside of it. I am, you know, this flew by so fast. I mean, I can't even believe it. Like there's so much here that I want to ask you about, talk to you about, but to no surprise of my own, what's the challenge we can leave people with to live the best possible version of their lives?
Well, I mean, first of all, Danny, I'm able to kind of say this, but I'm so proud of you.
Thank you, man. For what?
I love what you're doing. I love how you worked really hard to be a clear thinker. I can tell you're working really hard to be a clear communicator and, you know, to be a really, really active listener. And you're doing a really great job. And, you know, you're just doing so much more than I was at 28. It's pretty incredible. And so I just really appreciate that. And that's what I would just tell everyone is like, just relentlessly, ruthlessly, shamelessly, powerfully pursue the life you're supposed to live, you know, and don't wait for the applause. Don't wait for a lot of approval. You know, you'll get a lot of approval if you choose mediocrity. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a lot of approval if you choose the status quo. You're going to get a lot of approval if you choose the ordinary. And if you decide to break the status quo, to be extraordinary, to be unexpected, you're going to have fewer people cheering you on, but you'll actually live a life that will inspire other people to live their life as well.
And Erwin, you live a life that inspires me. So thank you so much for coming on here today, sharing a little bit about your thoughts, your ethos, and your way of being. Hopefully we can do this again. And where should we send people to connect with you further?
Oh yeah. Just go to erwinmcmanus.com. You can learn about our online mastermind called The Arena. You can find out about the books and learn about other things we're doing both at Mosaic and in the business space. ErwinMcManus.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Erwin. Hey, I appreciate the kind words.
All right. God bless, man.